Requesting connection. Established. Encrypted. We're live. The show you've been asking for. Advice, technology, and community. Linux first, all others second. This is Ask Noah.
Live from Multispeed Technologies, the Ask Noah show starts right now. This is the show where we came to do all the things on Linux they said couldn't be done and take your questions on how to do the same. The phone lines are open to be a part of the program. It is a free call, 1-855-450-NOAH. That's 855-450-6624, or send an email to live@AskNoahShow.com. My name is Noah Chalaya. I am your host, delighted to be here with you as another episode of the Ask Noah Show kicks off this evening. Joining me, my co-host, Mr. Steve Ovens. Welcome in, sir.
Good evening, Noah. How's things going this week?
I'm doing fantastic. 1-855-450-NOAH, 855-450-6624. You're on Ask Noah. Good evening.
Hey, Noah, a question for you. When you have a client that approaches you and says, you know, we're trying to come up with a forecast for how long all these routers and network equipment's going to last, where do you start?
That's a great question.
So basically, they're trying to come up with a 10-year plan for their, you know, they want to budget out of our IT equipment. And, you know, typically my clients just replace stuff as things break. They never ask me this.
Mm-hmm. Steve, do you have thoughts?
So I guess the enterprise version of this, not the small business, but the enterprise version of this is you go based on the extended support that they might offer for the warranty. Because at the point where, so if you want to be really cautious, you go just at the end of the warranty period. But if you look at the extended support, that is the reasonable amount of time that a company thinks they're still going to make money off of how long a thing is going to live. So that gives you some sort of benchmark. Like, if you look at the extended support and it's only 6 years, you're probably not going to get 10 out of it, or else they would milk you for it.
So a couple things I'll add to that. So there's a couple of different ways I approach this. So one way is what Steve said, the warranty approach. That's an easy one, right? Nobody ever got fired for saying, hey, that device is coming up out of warranty, so we'd recommend you replace it so before it hits warranty. The other thing that we've done, though, is I will sometimes add my own warranty on to things so that the client will buy it from me instead of buying it from a competing IT company. For example, if I sell a router and the manufacturer says the router's good for a year, I know good and well that router is going to last well over a year. And oh, by the way, I also happen to know that the thing that most likely goes out in those routers is typically the storage thing fails before anything else. And so I might say, hey, if you buy the router from us, we'll guarantee it for 5 years, something, you know, so I get the first year off the manufacturer, then we'll take the other four, something like that. The third thing, and this is typically where I start with places that are already at the place of like, well, we just run it into the ground and then when it breaks, we buy another one. What I typically encourage clients to do is buy a cold shelf, have that ready to go, and then when, let the failure dictate the time to replace. If they're a little bit more critical, swap it around. Buy a new one today, put the new one in today, then take the old one and place that as a cold shelf so that if a brand new, whatever it is, and I don't care what the warranty is, they all break. Every once in a while, you get a dud. Whenever, not if, that happens, you've got some redundancy and you've got a solution ready to go.
Fair enough.
Does that help you? And then some other things to kind of keep in mind. Roughly in the technology space, what I'll find is 3 to 5 years seems to be an acceptable. Now, this is just kind of a wet finger in the air. 3 to 5 years seems to be an acceptable frame to replace stuff, laptops, routers, switches. Nobody really seems to bat an eye if you say, hey, you know, roughly in this time period is where we'd look at fixing it. Now, can you go longer? Absolutely. We were at a client literally this afternoon that is a switch that's 15 years old and it still works fine and they have no intention of replacing it, and I haven't suggested they do so because it still works just fine. But if you're looking for like a where do I even start, that 3 to 5 years isn't a bad place to start, and then you can adjust based on their needs and budget.
Right, exactly. Yeah, same client has, you know, MikroTik router, ubiquity access points that I installed 8 years ago and they're working just fine, but they're kind of like wondering what's, you know, when are these going to die.
Yeah, 100%. And you can start getting...
I tell them they're on borrowed time. So.
Yeah, you probably are there. You know, the other thing that you could do is you could look at whatever it is you're going to next. If it's, you know, a nicer MikroTik router, or, you know, you could go look at some of the features or functionality that has that they don't have today and pitch the upgrade based off of the new things or the new capabilities that they would be able to do. So the most closest thing that comes to my mind is when the Wi-Fi spec iterates, right? And we go from B to G, from G to N, those kinds of things. Going back in there, especially when our clientele is a lot of hotels and stuff, going back then and saying, hey, you'll be on the newest standard, that has a huge appeal as well. And then you're not replacing so much dying stuff as so much as we're getting up to date and kind of keeping pace.
Yeah, I wasn't even trying to factor in obsolescence, but just, you know, dying.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what I would do. I appreciate the call. The way that I would frame that conversation is business continuity, right? Ask them, what is your tolerance for business continuity? If they say, yeah, we don't really care if we're down for a couple of days, that's fine. There's some hair places that they have what they call crash kits. And so if all the computers go down, they have pen and paper to do it. So they're less of a concern than like the hospital, right? Or I had a bar call me one time. They're like, listen, if we don't have this POS system back up by 6 o'clock tonight, we're going to lose $100,000 this weekend. Well, that's a bigger deal than, you know, so you can kind of let them judge. But in the way that I frame that to them is, what's your tolerance for business continuity? How important is it to you for you to keep all of these things up? And that'll kind of give you some guidance.
Sounds good. Thanks.
All right. Yeah. Give us a call back if you have any other questions. 855-450-NOAA, 855-450-6624. The email live@asknoahshow.com. So Steve, you had an interesting go around with, well, I won't say what the actual problem ended up being, but you noticed that you were having problems with VMs. You didn't know where to look. Walk me through your troubleshooting.
Yeah, so earlier this week, I was trying to install some of Red Hat's enterprise software, and normally it works really well, but every once in a while, when you've got new products or you've got a new release that's out or anything of the like, you might run into edge cases or bugs or things like that. And so I was facing a situation where I couldn't get the product to install, and I couldn't figure out why. And internal monologue was going something like, I can't believe we're releasing software that doesn't work. And the moral of the story here, before I even tell you where we went with this, is the people that build the software are probably smarter than you are, and it's probably an end user mistake.
But you'd be breaking tradition if the system administrator doesn't blame the software developer, and if the software developer doesn't blame the code?
Yeah, pretty much, right? So anyways, I couldn't get this to install. Like, it would install, say, 1 out of 20 times, and I couldn't figure out why is the installer failing? Like, it seemed like a weird thing. And so I'm, of course, turning on the debug for the software, and I'm going through the logs, and I'm doing all of this, the regular troubleshooting stuff, and still can't figure out why can't I get this installed. And I'm at day 3 of working on this, and I finally start thinking, well, okay, what's underneath me? Like, what do I need to do to peel back the requirements for installing the software? I have storage, I've got compute, I've got RAM, and you start going down, okay, well, I started running interactive graphs and watching the CPU. Okay, it's not CPU, you know, I've got 128 cores, I've got 512 gigs of RAM, you know, everything looks like it's okay. And so I start looking at IOPS and stuff like that. And this has got one of those PCIe NVMe trays. So it's splitting up the NVMe. It's got 4 or 5 NVMEs working together as one, sort of like a RAID 0 setup. It's not the IOPS. And I just keep going down the list. And eventually I happen to have been tailing journal control on the host, of the VM host. And I start seeing, every once in a while, there's an odd message that I don't understand. And so I started looking around, like, what does this message mean? And it turns out that I ended up having to dig into the inner workings of how NFS works, because I was using NFS storage for the VMs. And that's not bad, right? There's nothing that says that you can't do that. But what ended up happening was, the way that NFS works, especially on... just in general, what happens is, when the NFS server starts, it calculates the amount of RAM that it has and then sets the R size and the W size based on the amount of RAM that it has available to it. Then when a client connects, it says, hey, this is my R size and my W size, and this is, you know, basically how we're going to communicate. Well, when the system starts to become RAM constrained, even if you've got plenty left, but it just suffers a large amount of RAM disappearing over time, the NFS server automatically recalculates the R and the W size, but never notifies the client. So the client is trying to use the larger R and W size, and the server is no longer accepting that. And that can cause a lot of retransmission, or the serve, like the communication goes slower because of retransmissions and retries and refailures and stuff like that. And so once I discovered that, so essentially what's happening is the server boots and it's got all 512 gigs of RAM to it, mm-hmm. but then VMs turn on and installing the software, and now I'm down to 300 gigs. So as far as the server is concerned, it just lost 40% of its RAM from the time that it started up. And so it's now starting to scale back its R&W size, but never updates the client. And this is problematic.
What is R&W size?
So it's window size, and I forget what the R size is right off the top of my head. They are part of the parameters for determining how many packets to send and how big the packet should be. And it's basically communication. It's a communication protocol to determine how we're going to exchange information.
Got it. Okay.
So yeah, the moral of the story was, turned out that it was something underlying what I was doing, and software developers are smarter than I am, and they made software that works, and it was just end user, well, not even end user error, just unaccounted for, something I didn't account for when I was constructing this setup.
And so you switched to iSCSI?
Yeah, I ended up changing the protocol because ultimately the issue is that the renegotiation is happening, but the clients are never notified. So there's never, the clients never renegotiate. And so you can manually go and tell the clients to reconnect if that's a thing that is available to you. But one of my clients is a vSphere, and they don't like to be told to redo their storage once they've booted. You have to reboot them. And then that means taking down all of the VMs that it might be hosting. And so, yeah, big process.
A writes in this week and says, is there a GUI app that will let me build my own distro or ISO? A CLI way? I'd prefer a GUI for my first time to make it easy. What I'm thinking about is taking a current ISO for a distro, say Ubuntu, then adding the programs I want to use and baking them into the ISO. That way, I can just install Ubuntu with my programs already installed instead of installing Ubuntu and then having to go and manually install all my programs. I know Ansible is a thing, but building my own ISO or distro seems more fun and interesting to me currently. Thanks for the show, A. So first of all, I want to call this out. I love the fact that people feel comfortable writing into the show. I don't have to know your name. I don't have to know anything. All I have to do is know that this is how you wish to be identified, and you know what your question is. I like that. I like that he writes in as A, or she, or it, writes in as A. I think that's great. The other thing, though, here is, Steve, when you're talking about building a distro or an ISO, how does one actually go through, and how does that process typically work? Apart from if there's a GUI app, and I guess I'll just go out and say, I've never heard of one.
So I've never heard of a GUI app to do this sort of thing. I'm sure that they're out there. One of our producers or our members of the team mentioned that OpenSUSE build service might have something similar to this. I'm not really sure, to be honest. I've rolled ISOs before from command line utilities a long time ago, like 14, 15 years ago. I don't know what's current out there. One of the things that crossed my mind is back then there was also a way to install the utility once you've got your system up and running, and it would attempt to make an ISO out of what you have. So I suppose that is an option. But generally speaking, it is quite the undertaking. You might find a response for it. I think that you might have to go so far as to find the places where distro maintainers actually kind of frequent and ask them, because neither of us do this on the regular, for sure.
We don't. Here's what I do. What I do know from employing people that do this kind of work on the side: one, maintaining a distribution is very time consuming and very expensive. So if you want to go down the route, and it sounds like you do want to go down the route for self-improvement and to learn more about yourself, then I think that's a fantastic way to go. If you're thinking that this is a way to save time and effort, you might reconsider your thoughts. So one way to do this, and you mentioned this, right? Ansible, right? So you could absolutely declaratively say, I want to install Ubuntu, and then on top of that, I want this to be installed, configured, and work like so. That's one way to do it. The other thing is, so actually imaging the system, right, Steve? I mean, this is kind of comes back to the idea of like a recovery partition sort of a deal.
Yeah, you could absolutely do that. We don't really know what your ultimate goal is, and that makes the answering this question kind of difficult, at least from my perspective.
Yes.
Right? So
100%. Our second email comes from Carrie. Carrie writes in and says, for my home server, which is hosting VMs using libvirt and KVM, I'm trying to set up bridging as opposed to configuring my VMs to the directly attached server NIC. The limitation with the direct attached seems to be that none of the VMs can communicate with each other. I was wondering if you know of a good guide to setting up the bridging for libvirt KVM on Ubuntu. I've been trying to set it up via Ubuntu using NetPlan, and I've been having problems. I'm not sure if it's an issue with my configuration or possibly that I just don't understand bridging enough or if I'm making a mistake in my NetPlan config. I have my server connected to a dumb unmanaged Netgear switch and all the other hosts is plugged into it. When I try to set up bridging on my server, I apply the NetPlan config. Everything on that network loses its network connection. Do you have any idea what I'm doing wrong? Best regards, Carrie. So, a couple things here. So, Steve, I hope I'm not being... let me just say this. I'm almost kind of surprised to get this email because in my experience, typically with, especially on Ubuntu, if you were to install Cockpit, you would go into the Cockpit web UI, click on add bridge, and there you go. Bob's your uncle. Now you have a bridge. And all of the VMs are just going to speak through one physical RJ45 network jack as if they themselves had, basically it turns that network jack, the NIC on the server, into a switch.
Yeah, so there's a couple of different networking techniques here for virtualization, right? So the first and easiest one to set up is called a Mac VTAP. And essentially what that does is it does exactly what it sounds like. It taps into the MAC address of the host, which means that the host itself can't communicate with the VM, but it doesn't prevent any VMs from talking to each other. So that's one option. The other option is, of course, bridging, like the writer is talking about. There's nothing wrong with bridging. And you can do fancy things with bridging, like add extra NICs in there for failover and all kinds of fun stuff like that. In terms of setting it up, I used to struggle with this before Cockpit came around and was a thing. But like Noah said, ever since I was able to go into Cockpit and just click enable bridging, I haven't thought about it since. So I've been where you're at. I've had that pain. I would suggest maybe trying. So my first thought is, do you need to be able to have the VMs talk to the host? And if not, maybe you go with Mac VTAP, right? Mm. Because that is my default, unless there is something, like if I'm spinning up Prometheus in a VM and I want to monitor the host that it's on, then it absolutely has to be on a bridge,
mm-hmm.
right? Because it needs to talk to the host. But most of the time, I don't care or need my VMs to talk to the host. And Mac VTAP has, for me, worked every time without a problem.
So. Question for you. With Mac VTAP, does the host machine have to have an IP address on which the
no.
sub...
No.
Okay.
No. Interface can be unassigned for Mac VTAP. All it's doing is essentially allowing you to piggyback on top of the Mac address. And yeah. So it goes out through the switch and comes back in.
Our third email comes in from Michael. Michael says, hi, Noah and Steve. I've hosted my own email server for 15 years. Very small scale, but multiple domains. The biggest challenge is getting DKIM, DMARC, SPF, and reverse lookup all configured. Once set up, deliverability is usually fine. That being said, using your own static IP and not a VPS or a delivery service like SendGrid is probably less risky. I've done all three. I've used HMail server back in my Windows days, but have used PostFix and Dovecot since moving to Linux. I first used Mbox and MySQL and have been happier with MailDir for flat files. Feel free to reach out to me if you want to discuss. I'll be at Self in June. Speaking of that, setting up your own email server is probably a good Self workshop. Cheers, Michael. So again, I've said this every time and I don't want to overcommit myself. I'm not in the go host email yourself. Anything that is time critical has potentially high consequence for experimenting with. And I learned that firsthand. As I've talked about a couple of times on the show, I've been moving away from my phone. And one of the things that I've noticed, XMPP doesn't have an always on server. It doesn't have a bouncer like thing. So if my laptop is off, if it's not on, it's not getting text messages or XMPP messages, right? And so when people are sending my JMP, account, if that laptop isn't on, I'm missing those messages. And it's not until I go back and look at the actual phone that's been sitting, you know, in its charger at home that I have missed in a couple of things. And that's true of calls. It's true of SMS messages. And so when you're getting into the real-time thing and email's absolutely in that box, the consequences are real if you mess it up. So I'm not 100% there. However, when I'm looking for reasons to say no, and so when I look at self-hosting and I see, well, the biggest challenge is getting DKIM, DMARC, SPF all set up, in my mind, I go, yeah, but with mail in the box, if you're willing to let it do DNS, it will set all that up for you. So yet again, I have a check mark in the open source world. And then when I look to what I'm seeing in the proprietary world, you have any idea how many businesses have, what do they call it? What did they call it this week? Google Office, but G Suite or Office 365. And guess what? Plenty of those places don't have DMARC, SPF, and reverse lookup all set up. And I have gotten to the point now where there's organizations that deal with, well, we send too many emails to these other domains, and if you don't have these records set up, they reject those emails. And so I don't know. It doesn't seem to be perfect any place, but if you're hosting your own email, we want to hear from you. Our fourth email comes in from Nikki. Nikki writes in and says, "Hi, Noah and Steve. I'm rebuilding my NAS. My current setup is the root disk on a single solid-state drive. I don't have any data saved on the root disk, but the Debian operating system and some packages. I have mixed drive sizes. All of the data drives are Lux encrypted. I'm using Clevis and Tang to auto decrypt the data disks. The Tang server is located at the remote site at my parents' home, and we're connected via a site-to-site VPN with WireGuard and IPsec. My plan? To swap the hardware, motherboard, CPU, RAM to," and then he gives an updated model, "to keep the current setup, which is to leave the root disk as normal and the data disks as Lux encrypted. I live in an area that has tornadoes. My question is, what would be the possibility of decrypting my data disks since the root drive is not encrypted?" So, Steve, before we can really dig into this, can you talk a little bit about what Tang and Clevis are and how they allow for automated decryption?
So Tang is a server that you set up on a network somewhere, and the purpose of it is to allow for an automated decryption on boot. And a lot of people respond, well, that seems silly. Why would I encrypt my disk if there's something that will automatically decrypt it for me? And the answer to that is it depends on what your attack vector is. So Tang is meant to solve the attack vector of somebody like picking up your thing and literally walking out of the data center with it, or your laptop or whatever. So the whole purpose is to allow you to boot your computer and decrypt your disk unattended, because a big problem that you have, or that you could have, is, okay, my box is rebooted because of power outage, and I actually have to physically have somebody log into it somewhere in order to get it back online. And that's a problem when you're talking about enterprises, especially if you have an entire rack, for example, that goes down. So that's what Tang is meant to get around. So I'm a little bit confused in terms of what the listener is talking about for the decryption of drives, because in terms of why you would use Tang, if you're using Tang, then it's likely that you understand about automated decryption. Now, on the flip side of it, the question about, well, if my root drive is unencrypted, what is the chance of somebody being able to decrypt my data that is encrypted, like my data drives? And mm-hmm. The answer is the same as any other computer, right? If they breach your root drive somehow, mm-hmm. And they know what they're doing, and you've stored your encryption key on the computer itself, then there's nothing to stop them from doing that. So the answer to your question is, what is your attack vector here? That's ultimately what you need to answer.
I guess I struggle a bit too. It doesn't sound like there's a desire on his part to encrypt the boot drive. It sounds like that's unencrypted. It sounds like maybe the Tang server is just decrypting their data drive. So perhaps his question is, but I mean, he specifically asked, what's the possibility of decrypting the data disks since the root disk is not encrypted? I mean, yeah, we'd have to know where the encryption key is. I suppose. And then the other side of it is, what are you ultimately trying to accomplish? But write back in, let us know. We've also linked the appropriate knowledge base article from Red Hat on setting up Tang. And so if that helps you, or if it helps somebody else, they're listening, like, I didn't know that was a thing. I want to read about it. Great. Podcast.asknoahshow.com. He has a second question. Do you guys have a recommendation for an alternative to Gmail? Like you guys, I use Nextcloud, so I'd be using the Nextcloud calendar or storage, but I want to get away from Gmail and wanting to use email that has privacy and can be trusted. Right now, I'm using the free ProtonMail account, but I want to move my family, to family of four, to Proton or similar. Proton is kind of expensive. I was checking Tutanoa and Mailbox.org, but I couldn't find their pricing on their family plan. What's your opinion of these email service providers like Mailbox and Tuta? I know Tuta because it's open source, but that's all I know about it. So, Steve, you and I both have Proton subscriptions. Why?
Well, so first of all, I like the mission that Proton puts out. That's a part of it. The other part of it is I manage two different domains with like custom domain emails. And one of the things that I use is the catch-all, where it basically allows you to receive any email at your domain, which is really helpful for various things. And when Noah and I were talking about, well, could you simply just forward it, like put an email forwarder on your registrar and send it in? You could, but that you would end up struggling with how to filter the emails appropriately and stuff like that. So mm-hmm. I pay for the pro because it makes my life a little easier when dealing with multiple domains. And like I said, I like the mission that they support.
So that conversation came up in part because I honestly couldn't point to the feature of Proton, my paid Proton subscription, that I would say I couldn't live without this. I don't mind defining the email addresses ahead of time, meaning that I am perfectly comfortable using the forwards to say, hey, you know, and typically what I'll do is I'll use it as a mirror to reflect back at them. Oh, you're the Family Fun Center? Great. Your email is familyfuncenter@mydomain.com. And that goes into this folder. Oh, you're, you know, Jiffy Lube? Great. JiffyLube@mydomain.com. And you go into that folder. And I don't mind defining those ahead of time. But if you have everything coming to some sort of a catch-all so you can just make things up, then it could potentially be difficult to filter down the road. Proton, again, I get what you're saying. You know, if it's, it's like, for the family plan, I think their family plan started like $19.99 a month for up to six users, something like that. So I get what you're saying, where that can be kind of expensive. One thing to look at, I've dealt with I think it's Tutanoa, and they're okay. I don't have anything good or bad to say about them. Again, if I was looking for something, I'm probably just going to stick with Proton Mail. If you're looking for budget or you're looking for inexpensive, you might consider Fastmail. It isn't encrypted, so you're not going to get the privacy aspect, but part of my decision tree with that comes down to, is the other person using encrypted mail anyway? If the answer to that question is no, then it really doesn't matter. If the answer to that question is yes, then I think there's some value in things like Proton Mail or Tutanoa or any of the others, if you're all in that bandwagon. But Proton, I think it's like $2 a month or something like that for the, you know, for their starting fee. And, you know, very expensive. The other thing, I think Proton also has what they call their Mail Plus, and that starts at $4 a month. So you could, I mean, if you got four family members, I guess it still gets up there. But I guess the thing to consider is, how much do you want to support those services? How much do you value the concept of these companies that are willing to put their neck out there to provide privacy and, you know, the legal bills that come with countries and services that come knocking and asking for it? But my short answer, do you have recommendations off for anything alternative to Gmail? Anything. Anything is probably better than Gmail. Anything is better than Gmail or Office 365. So pick one and start marching that direction.
From the Linux Newswire newsroom, this is The Week in Review with JT.
For the week of April 21st, 2024, here's the Linux and open source news. Fedora 40 has been released. Tails 6.2 has been released with patches for the latest Intel Spectre vulnerabilities. Laka, based on the RetroArch emulator, has released version 5.0. The Wine team has released version 9.7. LXQT has reached version 2.0. The Mozilla team has released Firefox 125 this week and followed it up with two quick point releases for minor fixes. And Audacity 3.5 is out. In open source security news, the OpenSSF, CISA, and DHS collaborate on new open source project for creating SBOMs. A critical vulnerability in Atlassian Confluence data center and server has been discovered, and it is being used to deploy a Linux variant of the Cerber ransomware. Threat actors behind the Akira ransomware group have extorted approximately $42 million in illicit proceeds after breaching the networks of more than 250 victims as of January 1, 2024, and they are now targeting Linux servers. In open source AI news, Microsoft has released 5.3, a small open source LLM. And Meta has released a new 8 billion and 70 billion parameter model of Llama 3. And they have claimed that they will follow it up with a 405 billion parameter model soon. And the Gen 2 project has decided not to accept AI-generated code contributions.
Linux could soon be driving your car. That's not hyperbole, that's literally. One of the more interesting paradigm shifts underway in the automotive industry is the move towards software-defined vehicles. Cars have been increasingly controlled by electronic systems during the past few decades, but it's been piecemeal. Each new function, like traction control, anti-lock braking, or screens, instead of physical gauges, required its own little black box and its own little wiring loom. There's now more than 200 discrete controllers in modern vehicles, all talking to each other through a CAN bus network. The idea behind software-defined vehicles is to take a clean sheet approach. Instead, you'll have a small number of domain controllers that the automotive industry is choosing to call high-performance compute platforms, each responsible for a different set of activities. So they've broken it down into four, sometimes five different systems. The first is the vehicle dynamics. So this is what you typically think of when you say, you know, the powertrain, ABS, traction control, stability, control systems, those sorts of things. Everything you need to actually drive the car. The second system is the driver assistance systems. So that's things like your radar cruise and your ultrasonic sensors and controlling the automated driving systems. The third system is for your entertainment, right? So the music player and streaming and the audio system and all those sorts of things. The fourth system is cars' convenient features, things like climate or lighting. And then sometimes they have this fifth one, like the master control over everything. So it's interesting because I have a friend who bought a brand new truck, and he actually works for the dealership from which he purchased this truck. And he ordered the truck without lights in the bed, later decided he wanted to add the lights in the bed. So he purchased from the manufacturer, the correct lights that go into the bed, plugs them in, pushes the button, nothing happens. He, being an auto mechanic for the dealership for which this truck is made, has access to a hotline to help troubleshoot and diagnose issues. He calls and says, "Hey, put some new lights in my truck and I push the button and it doesn't work. What's the VIN number?" they ask. He gives them the VIN number. "I'm sorry, that feature isn't added to the VIN number." I'm sorry, what? "Yeah, when we ship the truck, there are features that are added to that car's computer and programmed via the VIN number. So to add a light, my friend had to pay the company about $200, I think, to have them add that functionality into the car's computer and then send a new programming file over that he placed on the computer. That's the world of automotive that we're living in. And so these software-defined vehicles, as they're motivated not by the ability to give you more control, not out of their desire to be more open source, they're motivated by their necessity to have safety-critical operating systems carry what's known as the ISO 26262 ASIL certification. And in order to be able to say, yes, when the person pushes on the brakes and that sends a little electronic signal to a computer and that makes we want to activate the brakes, that has to work every time. Like, you can't have a crash there, or you'll have a crash there. See what I did there? So the beauty of this concept, as they put it, you don't have to have or safety qualify Linux itself, said Moritz Nukecracker, a senior director at Electrobit overseeing the software-defined vehicles. Instead, an external safety monitor runs a hypervisor, intercepting and validating kernel actions. When you look at how safety is typically done, look at the communication. Don't safety certify the communication specs or the Ethernet stack, but you do a checker library on top, and you have a hardware anchor for checking down below. And you ensure that end-to-end, everything in between or out of the certification path, we now have created a concept that allows us to do exactly that for an operating system. In the end, we have roughly 4,000 kernel security patches within 8 years of Linux. That's the kind of challenge that you're being put up if you want to participate in that speed of innovation for the open source community as rich of that of Linux and now want to combine this with safety-related applications. So I think this is really cool. I was disappointed not to see more of Red Hat mentioned just from the standpoint that I know that they're heavily investing in this industry and have done a lot to bring a platform that does automotive stuff and facilitates this. But I'm happy to see that Linux is winning in this space, Steve.
I mean, anytime that there is some level of openness, it does potentially open the door for people to regain control over their vehicles in the long run. Like, let's say for whatever reason Ford stops supporting it, or whomever,
mm-hmm.
they stop supporting this the thing, or you've decided that you're no longer going to pay for the extended warranty and you are comfortable with the fact that you could cause the car to be non-functional, but you decide you're going to take a swing at fixing it yourself. At least you can do that, as opposed to how many times have we ended up with a proprietary thing that we can't fix because we can't even see what it's doing?
Yeah. Yeah. A friend of mine drives an Audi and he wanted to make some changes to it. And he had to go to a place, and I believe the process is called APR tuning. And the whole idea there is that it comes from Audi, from the German manufacturer, with a specific set of programming. If you want to alter that, you can't just download the software onto your computer, plug it in, and go for it. You have to go through them. Now, I'm not suggesting that car manufacturers, that this is going to open source everything and so you'll be able to, you know, plug in your laptop SSH into your car. I'm not suggesting that. However, I am suggesting that the standard on which we are going to base this new clean sheet is going to be something that is open source, that is powered by Linux, and therefore by nature has the ability to be hackable and maintainable and shareable and all the things we like about open source. Miracle Window Manager, or Miracle WM, it's a prototype tiling window manager that came onto the scene. It's somewhat in the mold of Sway VM, or Sway Window Manager, which, if you're not familiar with Sway, I would liken it to i3 with Wayland underneath. But with Miracle Window Manager, it's a Wayland inspired window manager, tiling desktop manager, and they write about it that such environments are the modern weapon choice for a lot of Linux folks who mainly live on the terminal. Quite a lot of people prefer to use console-based text tools rather than graphical file managers or a graphical text editor or graphical messaging clients and so on. So I really think tiling window managers get a bad rap in that way, from the standpoint that it's not just text-based things. So I would tell you that it boils down to simplicity, right? At some point, you get tired of playing the game of where did we hide the setting and where did we move that thing? And oh, now this thing crashed and so I can't minimize that or I'm going to lose. So at some point, you just get sick of that. And you say, you know what? I've got hardware that I want to use. The kernel does a great job at sending instructions to the hardware. So I've got these display devices. I have these input devices. I want to input and input things on these input devices. I want to call pieces of software code. I want to execute that code on my system. I want the results of said code to be displayed and proportioned or distributed out among my pixel real estate like follows. I want the simplest way to do that. What's the easiest, most efficient, simplest way, keyboard-driven way to do that? And thus, that's what I would tell you a tiling window manager is great for and why I've kind of gotten sucked into the hole and I can't get myself back out. It's great to sit down at the computer and fire a key command and say, I want this application to appear, and it does. Now, I want this application to appear, and it does. Now, I want to switch between these applications or I want to see them both at the same time. And really, any decision beyond that starts to rob me of efficiency. Where they suck, and I will admit this, Where it's great is when you know what you're doing ahead of time. I know that I need a terminal open. I know that I need a documentation window open where I'm text typing or I'm following along on a chat or I'm following along in a web browser. Or maybe there is no CLI at all. Maybe it's just a web interface and just the documentation. Whatever it is, you have the ability to do it with a tiling window manager. Where I think it kind of drives off a cliff, when you don't know what you're going to be doing, and, well, I need thing A, well, now I need thing B, well, now I think it's thing C and thing D, and pretty soon it's a catastrophic mess. And even there, Tiling Window Manager is going to allow you typically to hit a keystroke, and it will show you all of your available windows in just a searchable UI that I can just start typing, you know, XFCE or Firefox or whatever. That window pops up, I press enter, boom, I'm at that workspace, I'm now working on it. I think there's an efficiency argument that is left out, and this idea of, like, tiling window managers are really only for people that want to use text-based tools. I don't necessarily think that's accurate. However, this entire article, which I will link for you in the show notes of podcast.snoahshow.com, from The Register, talking about Miracle Window Manager. Yes, Miracle Window Manager is cool. It's very early days. They're on 0.02, something like that. 0.2. That is of note, and I'll continue to watch it. What I think is exceptionally cool about it is Miracle Window Manager runs on top of Mir. So at one point, Mir and Wayland were kind of fighting to say, hey, which direction we're going to go. When Wayland was kind of said, okay, this is kind of the direction we're going, Mir now serves as a compositor so that people that want to use Wayland or move over to it have that in-between layer and they don't have to build the entire thing from the ground up. So I think that's really cool. The other side of that is Mir is the team holds what they call office hours. And so this is a concept that first came into my purview with Alma Linux. But basically these projects have a set time and a set date where they are available and you can join an interactive call and say, hey, I want to get to Wayland on my distro and I'm having trouble with X, Y, or Z. How could Mir help or how would I properly leverage Mir? So they're doing that. And then the other thing that I thought I would draw your attention to is, are we Wayland yet? Which, if the notable list is all of the things that Wayland needs to do to be on feature parity with X, there's like two things missing. So I think that's really cool. As we kind of move into Wayland and it's becoming default in a couple of distros now, I think it's great. I think we're going the right direction. I think it solves a lot of problems. However, it is a simpler protocol. It is great, but for all of its complexity, X server is still very solid. And so, as is written in this article, so long as you can get it configured and displaying correctly, it almost never fails. An X11 window manager is just relatively a small part of the Linux graphics stack. If your window manager crashes, and dies, which can happen, it's not the end of the world because your programs keep running and you can get to a command line and try to restart the window manager and recover. If, on the other hand, your window manager is also acting as a Wayland compositor, which is relatively new and unproven code, then if it crashes, you lose everything. Your entire UI and all of your UI programs that were running. So I think early days, definitely some problems to solve yet, but I'm excited to kind of follow along. Steve, do you have a strong opinion or have you played with Wayland, or are you mostly a, like, give me whatever comes out and as long as it keeps working, I'm going to keep using it?
I've used Wayland a fair amount on laptops and stuff like that. I'm not particularly sold on it. It's been getting better. There's nothing particularly wrong with Wayland. It's more the applications that I have been used to have hit and miss experiences on Wayland. And so I think about things like remote desktop applications,
yes,
for example, is a big one. And even challenges with sharing screens over, I'm going to say, Skype or Zoom or whatever, where they might, maybe you get the share screen to work, but the audio doesn't come through, or like it seems to be very finicky. Now it's getting better, but a big driver for me coming back to X was all of these little paper cuts in front of clients, right? Like, sure, I could stop and try and debug it, but it's one of those things that it's really hard to explain for people that don't interact with the software on a wide variety. Like, you think that Microsoft Teams is Teams, or WebEx is WebEx, but that's not the case. Like, you can have a completely different experience on each one of these platforms depending on how the client has their thing set up. And so I have literally had it where I've spent a whole 8 hours on Teams jumping between three different clients, and screen sharing and audio was fine on one and completely fails on the other. And that's just a thing that I have not experienced under X. And so it's completely related to however the client is connecting on the back end, I'm sure. But it's enough that it's still not a daily driver for me. I'll let other people iron out those bumps.
So I think long-term stuff like WayPipe is going to be the answer for that. So it's going to leverage the ability to run programs over the network. And so just like X11 had its server-client relationship, and you could split those up, and typically they ran on one device, but when you wanted to, you could split the server from the client device, and so you could run the client display portion on your laptop and the server display portion on a remote box and tunnel it over the network and run graphical applications remotely. The entire way, by the way, that X2Go works, those things I think are going to come to us by way of WayPipe. So I think solutions are in the works. We're just, like Steve, I just don't feel like we're quite there yet. Qt in Ubuntu 24.04 shows there's room to innovate. This is another article from the Register. So they reference doing a roundup of the remixes for the last LTS cycle of 22.04 and notice that the Lubuntu distro was a bit different from the other flavors. So this time around, they noticed a few more functional differences. For instance, this release, the option to install directly from the boot up without having to go into the full desktop session was a welcome change, because the flavor, Lubuntu specifically, caters to people who want a lightweight OS. They want as minimal resources as possible. And one of the things I compliment the Register article on is they specifically talk about, even if you've got a machine that has a ton of resources, why would you burn through them? Right. And so Lubuntu allows you to take a very lightfoot approach. Quote, this highlighted the difference that we weren't expecting. As we reported back in February, the 24.04 release of Kubuntu is switching to Calamari's for installation programs. We tried a few different betas of both Lubuntu and Kubuntu to see how the new installer is looking. This highlights a difference that we weren't expecting. A three-way choice between installation types of beta, both Kubuntu and Lubuntu. You don't just get Ubuntu's normal and minimal, but you also have the optional full installation, which adds some extra packages to the mix. This adds Element Messenger client for Matrix, the Thunderbird multi-layer protocol, the virtual machine manager, and libvirt compatible hypervisors, KDE's Krita image editing program. So I think what's notable here, what's of interest is, well, the first things first. So the new Flutter-based installer for the Ubuntu desktop installer seems to be only on Ubuntu proper. The rest of, well, Kubuntu, Lubuntu, Ubuntu Unity all have focused on Calamari's, which has better partitioning in my personal opinion, has the same backend as the KDE partition manager, and again is used in Kubuntu, Lubuntu, and Ubuntu Unity. So I think there's some wisdom there in that installer choice. But the other thing is, I like that we're taking open source tools. And so if you're a person and you're walking through life going, I would just like to be able to run virtual machines on my computer, I don't know the first thing about virtual machines. Well, guess what? You just click, I want a full installation, and you're going to get access to image editing. You're going to get access to VMs. You're going to get access to encrypted messaging. And you don't have to know those tools exist. You just have to find them installed on your desktop and then use them. Some other 24.04 stuff that I think is worth noting. Kubuntu is obviously switching to Plasma 5, and Lubuntu has LXQT 1.3, which was their safe direction for the LTS release. Oh, and there was an AppArmor image, or AppArmor unconfinement user namespace issue in which Etcher wasn't working for a while, and that has been solved. Steve, are you still use Ubuntu on your servers, right?
I've been moving more and more away from them. I have a couple of Ubuntu servers left on physical machines.
And you're moving to Red Hat?
Yeah, I'm moving back to RHEL. I mean, we don't have to get into the long and short of it. I've just been very surprised, happily surprised with the way that Red Hat, like RHEL 9, works. Enough that it's been everything that I need in terms of a container platform and a development platform. I even run it on my AI machines, which might surprise some people. It's quite capable nowadays.
Is there any element, you know, when you were in school and you went and did a project and then you got to take the tool that you used to make the project home, or you got to take the project home and it was kind of like you got something out of the deal, sort of, so to speak. Is there an element of that? Like you use these tools all day long, in and out every day, and you know it like the back of your hand, so you want that same infrastructure when you get home? Or is it a purely pragmatically driven, I go to the distro that works, and today that's RHEL, and yesterday it was Ubuntu?
It's largely pragmatic. I mean, I really like some of the Red Hat software, that the enterprise software, and one of the perks of being a Red Hat employee is, of course, being able to run the full stack of Red Hat software. So there is some of that specifically for the software, but when it comes to the individual operating system, I need it to do its thing regardless of which operating system I'm using. And so for a while it was Ubuntu, and then I found that RHEL 9 brought a big parity. Not right away, but I found that it was enough of a paradigm shift for me in terms of its support for more modern software, like newer versions of Python and being able to support container workloads and stuff like that. I found that that was enough for me that it made it worth switching.
So here's an interesting piece of tidbit for you. I've been on Arch now for, I don't know how long this install has been going, but one of my, I guess, procedures has been when I go to reach for a piece of software and it doesn't work on Arch, which happens from time to time. So the latest one was Caden Live. Went to fire up Caden Live, didn't work. Why? I don't know. I don't really care. I've just gotten to the point where, okay, I'm done with the native package. I install the Flatpak. And you know what, Steve? My success rate with that, 100% of the software I need to run on my computer works.
Yeah, I mean, there's something to that, although Flatpaks are not geared at servers anyways, right?
No.
So there is a level of picking the right software for the job. I like a lot of Flatpaks as well, although, honestly, the people out there are going to roll their eyes, but I've moved from largely running Ubuntu servers to running a mix of RHEL and Arch servers. And part of that is because I find the Arch packages to be good for really fresh things. So like we talked about WeCan the other day, and I just installed that right out of the repo. And I like being able to pull things directly out of the repo as opposed to getting the software through containers. I'm just that weird person. I work with containers. I'm completely comfortable with them. But for whatever reason, when it comes to home, I don't want to stack a bunch of containers. I just want to like Pacman-S my software into place and call it a day.
100%. Hey, before we run out of time here, if you're going to be in the Seattle or Bellingham area this weekend, or this upcoming weekend, it is Linux Fest Northwest. It's going to be an absolute blast. I invite you to come out and join us. April 26th through April 28th at the Bellingham Technical College. It's been kind of a rocky road to get back to where we are after COVID. This will be the first big swing back where it's back in full force. That we did a small one last year at the end of last year, but we were able to get everybody at least out to the site and meet some familiar faces, but we'll be back in full swing. So join us for Linux Fest Northwest, April 26th through 28th. This show is recorded every Tuesday at 6 p.m. Central, AskNoahShow.com. We invite you to participate in the live show. We'd love you to do that. You can also head over to podcast.asknoahshow. There you'll find not only the articles and references we use to create the show, but all the stuff we didn't have time to get to, plus the entire show backlog. I'm on Twitter @KernelLinux. He's @Linux Evans. We're back next week, 6 p.m. Central, AskNoahShow.com.